Very pleased to be able to introduce Tobin Miller Scheer, our speaker today. He's not a stranger to EMU, but it has been 12 years, he tells me, since he's been on campus. He was last here doing research on his dissertation, which was a study of the role of Mennonites and racial relationships prior to and during the civil rights movement. I had the good fortune of being in Chicago at the same time that he was working on his doctorate, and got to see some early versions of that dissertation research and that later became his first book, Daily Demonstrations. Tobin is Associate Professor of History at the University of Montana. He's been there since 2008, and he also directs the third oldest African-American studies program.
And to Lois Schenk for excellent logistical support in getting me here, and others of you who've made me feel welcome even before I arrived. It's really good to be back in the Shenandoah Valley. So in a context where we'll be talking about racial identity, I'll start by acknowledging that even though I'm the director of African-American studies at the University of Montana, I do that work in the midst of acknowledging my racial identity rather than in spite of it. So, in short, I want you to know that I know I'm white. It's actually a sentence I use in every class I teach the first day because I think it's so important to be clear about that. I first encountered this photo 10 years ago when I was working in the record room of Eastern Mennonite Missions, a mission agency supported by Lancaster Mennonite Conferences. And the image grabbed my attention. It was taken by an EMM staff member to promote their children's visitation program, initiative begun on October 11, 1949, to bring, in the now dated and problematic language of the era, colored children from our city missions into church member homes. The program copied the much larger and more well-known initiative known as the Herald Tribune Fresh Air Fund, or the Friendly Town Program. The Fresh Air Fund had since 1877 brought children from New York City to the country and suburbs for 1 to 2 week summer vacations. Dozens of cities along the eastern seaboard, the Midwest, and parts of the West Coast had replicated the model, and by 1962, well over 1 million children had participated in the program as a whole. By the early 1970s, white hosts and African American and Latino guests dominated the program. The Lancaster Initiative had focused on African American and Latina children from its inception. Other than that basic context, I know little else about this photo. I do not know exactly when it was taken, although most likely it was in the 1970s. I do not know the names of the white crowd members. Neither have I been able to determine the name of the fresh air girl. She appears to be fairly young, probably 7 or 8, although not as young as some 4 or 5-year-old participants. I do know that the photo was taken at the train station in Lancaster City, so most probably she hailed from either Washington, D.C., or Philadelphia, or New York City. Note that she's wearing an ID tag around her neck. One fresh air participant said such tags made her feel like she was the subject of a slave auction. But it is the image itself that arrests me, as it did when I first saw it. Here, in high contrast, is a moment of concern. Perhaps the young girl's host didn't show up. Perhaps the white adults and the girl felt uncomfortable being photographed. But something is awry. Something has prompted this crowd of women and children, along with one man out in front holding some document, to hover around this fresh air child. If nothing else, the photo evokes vulnerability. The fresh air guest appears outnumbered, overwhelmed, far from home, at the mercy of strange white people. I will begin and end this lecture with a question, a query that I share with you now and ask that you think about through the rest of the talk. The question is simply this: what should I do with this photo? How do I interpret it? How central should it be in my research? For the past decade, I've paid close attention to Fresh Air hosts and guests, examining over 50 different programs in 20 states involving thousands of hosting sites. This is only a partial sampling you see in front of you. In so doing, I've learned much about racism in the country between 1939 and 1979. And the invitation to speak here at EMU has prompted me to think about my sources in a new way. It has given me the opportunity to look again at the themes of sex, seven, and sass as elements of how we have envisioned home, of how we have thought, in the words of Emily Rabiteau, about Zion. I will argue this afternoon that study of the Fresh Air movement shows how the social forces undergirding these three themes made the practice of racism in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s so intractable. At the root of concerns about interracial sex sat a pervasive fear of the racial other, a deep desire for racial innocence set up age-limited exchanges. And beneath intense scrutiny of manners and conduct lay a bedrock conviction of white supremacy. By evaluating these underlying social forces of fear, innocence, and superiority that sat behind the themes of sex, seven, and sass, we may also discover new ways of responding to racism and imagining home today. First, the Fresh Air racial context. In the 1950s, most Fresh Air ventures shifted from white ethnic to black and brown children while still allowing hosts to indicate their racial preferences, a practice that continued through the 1960s. As a result, more white, rural, and suburban people from the Northeast and Midwest came into intimate contact with people of color through Fresh Air programs than through any other social organization, governmental program, or grassroots initiative. More intimate than schools, more far-reaching than the military, more integrated than churches, and more sustained than civil rights marches, Fresh Air programs offered an easily replicable model for doing something concrete about racism. Press accounts and accompanying photos in Montana, New York, North Dakota, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Vermont focused on white host children and adults in close physical proximity to dark-skinned children from the city. Whether displaying children in the act of fishing, eating food, or walking side by side through a parking lot, reporters and many cartoonists turned repeatedly to scenes of inoffensive integration in which white hosts and African-American children figured prominently. The Fresh Air programs that became linked with white suburbanites hosting black and brown city children based their publicity on a string of heartwarming anecdotes. Consistent with post-World War II celebration of liberal cultural pluralism that prompted white people to develop interracial relationships, by the middle of the 1950s, Fresh Air publicists had begun to promote the racial benefits of their programs. According to the accounts, African-American and Latino children and their white hosts held hands, shared playthings, and accepted each other without condescension or paternalism. In addition, the African-American and Latino guests righted racial wrongs, crossed racial boundaries, and solved racial problems. Fresh Air promoters became so convinced of the effectiveness of their model that they even argued it could calm racial foment. In 1968, during one of the most intense periods of urban unrest, Herald Tribune Fresh Air president Blanky Noyes used the occasion of a fundraising letter to assert that sending, quote, Negro and Puerto Rican, unquote, children to the country could prevent pent-up frustrations from erupting during the hot summer months. But all was not as wonderful as these assertions suggest. On the virulent end of the spectrum, in 1961, one African-American child listened as his assigned host in Plattsburgh, New York, exclaimed to the local Fresh Air organizer, and here I will quote a racially offensive term that is as problematic now as it was at the time, "You didn't tell us that this kid was going to be no nigger." Oral histories from former Fresh Air children make clear that local residents frequently use racial epithets and hate speech in front of the visiting children. Other incidents proved just as troubling. In a small town in Michigan, the managers of a local beach prohibited an African-American visitor from entering the water. In New Jersey in 1964, the parents of neighborhood children prohibited them from playing with two Fresh Air visitors, declaring that under no circumstances were the African-American guests to put as much as 1 foot on their property. Children also encountered hostile stares while out in public, overheard crank calls by residents opposed to the program, suffered racist comments from adult neighbors, and listened to other children call them names. Amid this racial animosity, the children nonetheless sought to educate the adult hosts around them. Stemming from the decades-long struggle of African-American organizers and educators like Mary McLeod Bethune, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Carter G. Woodson, recognition of white responsibility for racism intensified during the 1950s, and Fresh Air advocates began to echo the sentiment that whites in the suburbs were the ones with much to learn, unquote, by the 1960s. The program soon centered on white-black exchanges and offered glowing reports in which hosts wept at the children's departures. Neighbors welcomed dark-skinned guests, and the children lessened bigotry, prejudice, and deprivation in the country so as to bring the dawn. By 1965, as white resistance to housing rights and affirmative action picked up steam, many Fresh Air initiatives focused on educating the white hosts as much as on improving the children. The racial context of the Fresh Air programs is thus conflicted. To be certain, children educated their hosts about life in the city and countered racist stereotypes, all the while resisting the paternalism of the era, and by doing so, initiated some of the few conversations about racism that white rural residents ever had. At the same time, only a few Fresh Air programs responded to the 1971 challenge by John Powell, a Mennonite black nationalist religious leader, to set up stale air vacations in which white kids from the suburbs spend time with African-American Latino kids in the inner city. From the 1950s forward, the internal tension between the children's educational efforts and the racism of the hosting communities suffused the Fresh Air movement. Sex amplified these racial tensions. The entry of children from African-American and Latino communities into white host families in the mid-1950s and afterwards introduced the threat of racial mixing. U.S. history makes evident that, quote, "no American issue ever ignited as much fire as amalgamation." That is the mixing of races. After the Supreme Court overturned legal segregation in the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education ruling, segregationists revealed deep-seated fears that interracial schools would lead to interracial sex. As white youth listened to black music replete with sexual themes, the segregationists' worries intensified. The nationally publicized North Carolina kissing case in 1958 drives home the point. White mobs and police officers terrorized two black boys, 1 8, the other 10, for playing a kissing game with three white girls. Comments from white anti-school busing activists in cities like Boston reveal similar fears in the North about interracial sex. Organizers of Fresh Air Ventures assuaged fears of racial intermixing by presenting physical intimacy in as non-threatening a manner as possible. During the 1950s, when interracial hosting first became common, publicity shots featured white hosts touching or at least being close to African-American children as they welcomed or comforted them. As African-American children came to dominate the program in the 1960s, publicity materials featured host parents kissing their guests goodnight, holding their guests' hands while walking to the car, or playing games on the living room floor. Only at the end of the 60s did images begin to appear in which guests and their host siblings draped arms around each other's shoulders, tossed each other in the pool, built an interracial human pyramid. By the 1970s, photographers focused on black guests hugging or shaking hands with their white host siblings, but only in same-sex pairs. At no time did promoters allow the suggestion of physical contact across race and gender lines, except in such endearing cases as when a white father cradled a napping African-American girl. This careful crafting of intimate physical intimacy images proved all the more troublesome when evidence of sexual abuse by hosts became public in the mid-1980s, evidence that's been corroborated by my own research on the Fresh Air movement as a whole and among Mennonite hosts in particular. Yet romantic interest between children and their hosts still blossomed. Private correspondence to Fresh Air administrators revealed host concerns about interracial attraction. One local host wrote, "One of your black boys was much interested in our white girls." Another expressed the opinion that it would also be wise if older black boys could be placed in homes where there are no girls, read white girls, their age. Still another local organizer stated his concern even more obliquely by suggesting that Fresh Air children be placed in different homes each summer because familiarity in this case might lead to certain problems. During the middle of the 20th century, fears about interracial sex permeated Fresh Air programs. These persistent fears arose from the racialized stereotypes of black men as sexual predators that led to so much violence in both the North and the South. Fresh Air organizers refused to talk forthrightly and directly about the history of fear-mongering about interracial sex and how that history shaped expectations about the hosting of black and brown youths. By contrast, the National Council of Christians and Jews did address those issues at that same time in their interracial camping and hosting program. Most white organizations, however, like the Fresh Air Movement, avoided the topic at all costs. And now for seven. I mentioned earlier that some children as young as 4 or 5 were sent on Fresh Air vacations. What I didn't clarify was how few returned to host locations after they turned 13. The theme of seven, referencing here the age preferred by a majority of Fresh Air hosts, reveals the lopsided nature of the programs. Lawrence Mikulik revealed much about the age dynamics of the Fresh Air program when he explained gender inequity in the Fresh Air camp program. For 23 years, Mikulik had directed camps for the Herald Tribune Fresh Air Fund, and by 1978, Mikulik had found ways to deal with troublesome boys since he allowed them to attend camp until the age of 16. Girls, however, had to stop once they turned 13. As he explained to a reporter, Fresh Air camps served girls only through the age of 12 because they're a little too sophisticated these days. His concern had nothing to do with the girls' erudition. He referred to the onset of menstruation and the girls' understanding of sex. In response, Mikulik set an age cap. Home-based programs had put a similar age cap in place on girls and boys for much of the 20th century. By putting the age cap in place for girls in camp settings as well as homes, Mikulik and other Fresh Air administrators joined in the project of simultaneously shielding girls from sexual advances and reducing the threat of their supposedly unchecked sexuality. Fresh Air programs often allowed hosts to select their guest age and extend reinvitations to former guests through their mid-teens. The policy of host preference again forestalled concerns about sexual contact between adolescents. Host's preference for younger children likewise emphasized their reluctance to engage guests who had lost the sexual naivete of a 7-year-old. Only a reinvitation from a prior host would bring a teenager to the country. Few administrators spoke publicly about their attitudes regarding the extension option, but in 1978, Carolyn O'Keefe, a host placement volunteer, let slip that older children are the subject of debate among Fresh Air officials because at 13 or so, unless they've had a lot of positive summer experiences, a kid on the Bronx is on the streets for life. O'Keefe inferred widespread distrust of teenagers and strikingly a lack of faith in the efficacy of the summer hosting program itself. But such candid comment was rare. A conclave of Fresh Air representatives in the mid-1960s shed light on the frequent use of the term sophisticated in discussion about age caps. 70 administrators, volunteers, and staff people gathered in New York City to share ideas and address issues arising from hosting, quote-unquote, inner-city youth. In the midst of a wide-ranging discussion, a participant asked why new invitations are limited to 12-year-olds. In response, an unidentified conference member noted, "Generally, youngsters over 12 years of age are more sophisticated than children of the same age in friendly town communities." As a result, the conference goer added, "adjustments are difficult." He hears elsewhere that adults use the term usually reserved to describe upper-class refinement as a euphemism for knowledge about sexual relations. Hosts desired children who remained ignorant of such intimate matters. Another participant in the New York conference noted invitations for children 10 and over are minute compared to younger age groups, but spoke about that preference in the most oblique manner possible. Those children interested in maintaining connection with their host into their teens had varying experiences. Some, like Luis and Nelson Diaz, two brothers from New York who participated as guests in the programs in the 1970s, lost track of their hosts once they became teenagers, but felt quite positive about the experience as a whole. As an adult, Luis even reconnected with his original host family via a social media site. Others, like a group of teenage girls from Gulfport, Mississippi, who traveled to Newton, Kansas to attend school at Bethel College, discovered that the warm welcome they had received as children as part of the Fresh Air program had cooled considerably. In addition to being denied the privilege of associate church membership, the young women confronted racial epithets, found dating difficult, and received unequal treatment in host homes when on a choir tour. Many other Fresh Air children reported a similar sense of alienation upon entering adolescence. Glenda Adams recognized a former host sister when she arrived at a first year as a first-year student at Calvin College, but received no acknowledgement in return. Peggy Curry, the mother of a Fresh Air child here in Harrisonburg, Virginia, noted that her daughter never received another invitation to a host family in Pennsylvania once her daughter had become a teenager. Although some children did maintain connection with former hosts into adulthood, the Fresh Air model did far better at fostering short interactions than it did at sustaining long relationships. Fresh Air rhetoric and promotional material overwhelmingly focused on young, prepubescent children from African American and Latino communities building short-term relationships with the white families that hosted them and being shaped for the better by the exchange. To host a Fresh Air child was to the white hosts to strike a blow against the deprivations of the inner city. But more importantly, it was to demand that relationships across racial lines be rooted in innocence. As a 13-year-old from Harrisonburg wrote in a letter explaining why she wanted her family to host a Fresh Air child, she wrote, "In New York City, there are 13 million people. 83% worship idols. 90% of the school children drink strong drink. Crime is so great that the school teachers and officers are stumped to know what to do. We can help," she wrote in her letter, "by taking some of those children that come from there and show them what real life is." Children, rather than adults, were brought out of the city because they might yet be saved through the exposure to real life. Once they lost their innocence by becoming adolescents, most were left to the sirens of the city. But the Fresh Air children did not always follow the script written about them. Take, for example, Sonia and Lelia. These two young Fresh Air campers had had enough. Only a few days into their two-week stay at Fresh Air Camp, they longed for attractions they enjoyed back in Brooklyn and Manhattan. Even though their counselors encouraged them to relish the rocks and birds and plants, have scavenger hunts and picnics, and go home with suitcases full of speckled stones and swimming cetaceans, the girls would have none of it. They wanted to watch movies and spin on merry-go-rounds in their home neighborhoods. Rather than be miserable in a nature-filled environment they detested, the girls decided to catch a bus back to New York. Although foiled by a quick-acting counselor who spotted the girls as they scrambled through the bushes in their bid for freedom, the girls had made their preferences clear. One counselor noted that campers like Sonia and Lelia were growing up, assertive, hostile, unsatisfied, hard to handle, and got into fights and caused trouble. At the age of 10 in the summer of 1971, the girls had gotten sassy. Sonia and Lelia fit the profile of sassy, ill-behaved guests. They took no pleasure in nature, despised the activities prepared for them, and resented the authority of the local hosts. They had one desire while visiting the Fresh Air Fun Sharp Reservation. According to Lelia, they wanted to get back on the streets. Good guests, by contrast, loved to hike, relished swimming, and adored their hosts. Rather than pine for cityscapes, well-behaved guests grew tearful at the thought of returning to New York. Whether the two girls eventually found some measure of fulfillment amid the camp regimen, where they grew to appreciate their counselors, or whether they came to find nature attractive remains unknown. We have only the image of them sitting on the ground, bereft, defeated, still longing for the streets of Brooklyn and Manhattan. Sonia and Lelia acted out in the midst of a 1970s era filled with the cultural and political backlash against the freewheeling excesses of the 1960s. Fresh Air promoters maintained that anti-juvenile delinquency program improved manners and in some cases rescued children from lives gone bad. Due to the love and attention heaped upon him, an 11-year-old Fresh Air camper stopped verbally harassing his fellow campers in 1972 as he discovered a newfound incentive to behave. That same year, Frederick Gibson, a New York City police detective volunteering at a Fresh Air camp, added that the program not only prevented children from joining gangs in the first place, but also allowed some to break away after they had become members. Lisa Pulling, the Fresh Air Fund's director in 1975, highlighted the preventive aspect of keeping 16,000 children off the street each summer, a theme repeated throughout the decade. In addition, at least one parent mentioned in 1977 that her child learned table manners while she was away and started teaching his sisters and brothers when he returned home. Yet other children chose not to cooperate in the same way, especially during the foment of the latter 1960s when black nationalist and La Raza rhetoric captured the imagination of many urban residents. As adults criticized discriminatory practices of sponsoring organizations and demanded neighborhood youth be regularly consulted and involved in their own program planning, the children also spoke out. In 1966, an Episcopalian Fresh Air summer day camper asserted that rather than being culturally deprived, he and the other campers had their own culture replete with soul music and Spanish slang. 2 years later, a participant in a Fresh Air Fun camp informed her two counselors, one of whom was white and the other black, that she would get the NAACP after them if they dared to discipline her. The same year, a 7-year-old boy informed his host father, "I don't like white people." Although the intensity of the rhetoric waned in the following decade and some of the children dropped their bluster once they learned to know their hosts, Fresh Air children contributed their voices to the persistent critique of white liberal paternalism, typically associated with much older racial activists. So how do we understand the conflicting evidence of both children's angelic cooperation and their sassy misbehavior? On one level, the children were just being children. Like most children, at some points they cooperated, and at others, especially when they were tired or out of sorts or trying to get attention, they didn't cooperate with their host's expectations. The point here is that their behavior was under sharp scrutiny. Given the limited interactions that the white suburbanites had with people of color, the attention they gave to the behavior of the children was disproportionately intense. The actions of one child often came to represent the attitudes and behaviors of an entire racialized community. Thus, most commonly, the white hosts and their children were, as one Harrison Burke host noted in 1973, surprised to see their guest carry his own plate to the sink after meals and scrub the tub after a bath without being asked. The hosts approved. The child had exceeded their expectations. But it is their surprise that jumps out. The hosts had expected to give the children the benefit of their supposedly superior home environment. As a host in 1968 pointed out, all the time our guest is being flooded with our values and our ways of life. The Fresh Air program sent the message that the white hosts in the suburbs were giving the inner city children the chance to experience, as the director of the Fresh Air program opined, a much better life. Some of the young Fresh Air children came to internalize the message, as did Christine Morelli, who looked back on her experience as a Fresh Air child in the Harrisonburg area and said, "We came away with a sense of hope that there was still a chance to grow out of the slums, finish school, get a job, marry, and someday give our children a life similar to the one people enjoy in Harrisonburg, Virginia, Rutland, Vermont, or Syracuse, New York." Others, like a Fresh Air child who had spent many years among white Mennonites in the Kelowna, Iowa area, told me bluntly that there were some good things about the experience, like being able to be in the grass, being able to be barefoot, things we didn't get to do in the city. But then she concluded, "The rest of it can go to hell. I wish I had not had that experience, because it was 2 weeks of being afraid, 2 weeks of people staring at us, poking at us, asking us ludicrous questions." The story of sex and fear, seven and innocence, and sass and superiority in the Fresh Air movement during the middle of the 20th century is not a new one. The rhetoric offered by the promoters of the Fresh Air program did not match the children's experiences. Claims that two-week summer stays in the country and suburbs would bridge the racial divide, overcome class divisions, build long-lasting relationships, and improve the children's outlook on life did not take into account the systemic realities of structural racism in healthcare, education, employment, housing, and transportation. No matter how much publicity was generated, how many heartwarming anecdotes were told, or how widely the program was promoted, it could not begin to address these systemic realities. In this, the programs were not unique. This is the story of white liberalism in the 20th century. It's the oft-repeated tale of white-dominated, well-meaning, naive programming, political initiatives, educational approaches, and economic policies failing to deal with the structural issues that kept racial inequity in place. So one of the first lessons we learned from the mid-20th century Fresh Air story is just how hard it is to move beyond white-led palliative programming. The white participants in the programs invested tremendous amount of money, time, energy, and hope into bringing inner city children into their homes. Thousands still do so every summer. The difficult message is that such programs make the problems of racism worse. They do not make it better. In the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, Fresh Air programs compounded the problem of structural racism by contending that externally generated solutions work best to overcome the difficulties faced by communities of color. Those from outside communities of color asserted that extracting African American and Latino children from their homes was the best way to address racism. They maintained that the white suburban and rural way of life would provide the best possible resource for guiding poor black and brown children through life's challenges. Again, this story is not new. Historians have repeatedly revealed the story of white liberal paternalism and its failures in our nation, states, towns, and religious communities. So what is new about the Fresh Air narrative? The Fresh Air story is new only in as much as it reveals just how seductive is the message that we can make big, complex, costly problems like racism go away by doing small, simple, inoffensive actions. that message was incredibly attractive to white suburbanites, especially during the period of racial foment that began in the 1950s, stormed through the 1960s, and reverberated through the 1970s. Rather than deal with the fears of interracial sex, stop demanding that innocence be a prerequisite to interracial relationships, or refute the assumption of white supremacy, organizers let slide sex, seven, and sass. Ignoring those issues allowed them to feel like they were making a difference when so much around them seemed to be spinning out of control as thousands of civil rights activists took to the streets to challenge that white supremacy. So as I turn to a close on this Wednesday in the week that we celebrate the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr., I'm reminded of a passage in Emily Rabiteau's Searching for Zion. About five chapters into the book, she recounts an exchange with her father. She begins by quoting him as saying, "You're searching for Zion. We feel personally injured that America isn't the promised land. This could be described as a black feeling. While it may be true that this nation was founded on the utopian ideals of religious freedom, it's just as true that it was founded as a result of a growing global economy that exploited the labor of slaves. Right?" Emily responds, "Right." And then she continues quoting her father. "But the promised land, at least the one Martin Luther King spoke of, stands over and against nation-state idolatry. It subverts nationalism and borders and the kind of island mentality of pushing you're number one or us versus them. King wasn't talking about a country when he talked about Zion." In response, she asked, "What was King talking about?" She concludes by noting, "My father smiled wearily. What kind of teacher would I be if I just told you the answer?" So should I tell you the answer, or at least my answer to Emily's question, or should I leave you hanging? I'll conclude by doing a little bit of both. 2 days ago, I turned 51. That means for nearly three decades, I've been thinking about, struggling over, organizing against, and writing and teaching about the problem of race in America in general, and in the Mennonite Church in particular. A journey that began when I was a much hairier student here at Eastern Mennonite College at that point in 1987. And I'll just note that I look a lot different, but my wife doesn't. She'll be embarrassed when she hears me say that, which is a good thing. We traveled down to New Orleans to start a term with Mennonite Central Committee after we graduated. In many ways, my anti-racism work has been informed, shaped, and guided by instructors that helped shape me here at EMU. I owe a debt to people like Jim and Ann Hirschberger, Lee Snyder, Omar Eby, Rick Yoder, Orv Gingrich, Ray Gingrich, and many others too numerous to name. Although they didn't know it at the time, they prepared me for a career as an activist and now as a scholar to probe complex questions, make difficult decisions, and bring faith to bear on the life of the mind. For those gifts, I'm grateful. Coming back to this community for a few days is in many ways a stage in my own search for Zion. I've come back to a community where I was born, went to college, and was married. Yet like Martin Luther King, I'm convinced that the notion of a utopian home is not and can never be defined by a physical place or national, political, or even religious boundaries. Like Emily Rabiteau, I too think about Zion as an internal state. She writes at the end of her book, "Zion is within. I understood that I would forget this fact and, as with love or faith, have to learn it again." At the same time, we mark our journey toward home, toward Zion, through physical as well as metaphysical passages. Returning to home places helps us recognize who we are and perhaps indicate where we next want to go. The fresh air children I have encountered in my research carried out their own search for Zion. The promoters who sent them by train and bus and car to faraway places thought that the smell, sights, and tastes of the countryside would save the children from an urban environment the fresh air promoters deemed not only inferior but corruptive. A small percentage of the children like 9-year-old Charisma Jackson, who returned home to New York City after only a few days away here in Harrisonburg, were sent home early because they had become homesick. The children had not found Zion in the countryside. Yet something else happened that none of the boosters could control or otherwise curtail, even among those children who stayed the full 2 weeks in the country and enjoyed it. In recounting their return to the city, former Fresh Air children repeatedly recalled that rather than crying and weeping when the bus entered the city limits, the children would often break into spontaneous applause. Sometimes they would even cheer. They had arrived back home. One young Fresh Air boy, upon walking out of the subway onto the sidewalks of New York City, declared, "Gee, it smells good to be home." He had found his Zion not among manicured suburban lawns, but on the streets of the city. He knew those streets and they knew him. By calling the city home with all its challenges and opportunities, he undermined decades-long efforts to tell a story in which the country and suburbs claim the status of Zion. And now I return to the question that I started with. What do I do with this photo? Do I excoriate it as yet another example of the paternalistic excess of naive white people wanting to desperately do something about the state of race relations in America, but lacking the resources, whether social, historical, or political, to offer a more nuanced response? Do I ask for pity for the black girl as she waits for someone to figure out what to do with her? Do I ignore this photo and focus instead on happier images that affirm the kindness of white hosts who took black children into their homes? No, I choose to do none of those. None of them are entirely accurate responses. They're all too simplistic in their own way. So rather than castigate or valorize, I will leave this photo before us. It's a complex image, one that speaks about sex, seven, and sass, about fear, innocence, and superiority, one that's replete with notions of home, an image that resonates with our own political moment, a time when we are faced in ever more pressing ways with questions about how we determine the boundaries of home and how we decide whose lives matter inside our national household. Thank you. I think we've got some time for questions. I'd be delighted for any conversation that we have to extend the thought. Yeah, David.
Thanks for your presentation. Incredibly fascinating, intriguing on many levels. One of the first things that came to mind as I was looking at the image and listening to you talk were the orphan trains.
Ah, yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a different situation in some ways, but sometimes similar. Mm-hmm. And in this way in particular, that in all of these images, and even in your presentation, the black children's parents were nowhere.
Absolutely.
So it leads us to assume, in some ways, by their absence, a narrative that is very familiar in this nation that black people don't have families.
Yep.
We don't have parents. So paternalism, I think, is an accurate term to use. But I wondered, in your research, if you ran across the opinions, the thoughts of the parents of these kids, mm-hmm. And if you plan to, to make them present in your research.
Yeah, they're present in the book project as a whole, and I talk about the fact that the rhetoric from the Fresh Air program so consistently made them invisible. Once in a while, there were letter exchanges between the host families in the suburbs and rural communities and the parents in the city, but it is remarkable how they were absent. I've gotten a couple sources that bring the parents into the picture, and I've figured them prominently in one of the chapters in particular, especially when we begin to notice over time the ways in which the children most often refuse to tell details about their home life. I actually talk about it as a principled position the children were holding, and we have now been able to trace that back to the parents telling them, What happens in our home stays at home, because they knew there was a history of white social service agencies taking their children away if they got rumors that they weren't treating them in ways that were conforming to the white norms and standards of what a good parent did. So yeah, that is definitely part of the analysis that I'm bringing, and it's absolutely stunning how invisible those parents are. Other than a statistical representation and a phrase or two, they come from broken homes, which is its own fascinating point of exploration. But you put your finger right on the money. Absolutely. Yeah, thanks.
Hi, I'm Brian. I'm curious about the relationship between the urban mission, which I think you talked about, and the families.
Right.
And so selection process, but also any follow-up, what was happening in the city in relationship with maybe Mennonite mission agencies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the national movement as a whole had a variety of means by which the children came to Fresh Air attention. A section of them were religious groups. Consistent across them was that there was intensive scrutiny and vetting of the children and almost no vetting of the homes they were sent to. That was part of the analysis of the sexual abuse that happened because there was no screening. In the case of those portions of the Fresh Air movement that were religiously based, most often the summer vacations were seen as bait to get the kids to behave in Sunday school class. Sometimes they even had to do Bible memorization in order to earn the right to go to the country. Most of the parents were written out of that story there as well, because it was primarily a way to get kids into the church. In fact, there's some fascinating statistics that the actual membership, particularly of African Americans in the Mennonite church in the 50s and 60s, that was mostly kids under 12. And I show in my work that's mostly connected to the Fresh Air initiative and the kids wanting to go. It wasn't that they didn't want to do this, but the children themselves recognized how problematic an initiative it was. I find the partnership between the White City Missions and the Fresh Air Program as a whole at points quite problematic, because implicit in it was the suggestion that the very place they're doing ministry was not as good as the place that they were sending the kids in the country. And that comes up in the rhetoric, particularly through the mid-70s in many of the church-based initiatives. Again, not just Mennonites, but across the board. So it was a hand-in-glove, and I think somewhat self-defeating relationship there, because they were seeing the city that these kids were coming from as somehow inferior to this ideal place in the country. And it's fascinating for some of the adult kids I interviewed, adults talking about their experience as kids, of their awareness that this wasn't just about sending them to a place to get an exposure to other religious communities, to get an exposure to places where there were more cars and bigger houses and other signs of wealth. And that was part of what it meant also to be in this country setting. Am I answering your question? Any of that? Yeah, thank you. It's very helpful. Rick.
Thanks. If I understood you right, your sources of data were secondary, archival?
It's a combination. I've done over 50 oral history interviews with former children, administrators, and other participants, and the rest were letters written by the children at the time. Archival data, actually, Fresh Air Fund refused me access to their archives, the whole story about that. I was able to get it through other documents and other sources about 25 different archives across the country. So it's a combination.
Okay. Because what I'm wondering is, if you're able to identify people who are in the Fresh Air program still living, who are adults at some level, and you had some criteria by which you could measure some sort of outcome.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, whatever that criteria is, and then had a sample of people who are in the Fresh Air program, and also got a random sample of some sort of those who weren't in it, and compared the differences.
Yeah. If I was a social scientist.
Are you doing anything like that?
If I was a social scientist, I'd be all over that.
History is a social science.
But as a historian, it's a little bit outside my purview. It's samples and statistics and everything. It's interesting that the Fresh Air Fund towards the end of the 70s began to dabble in that because they began to be criticized that you're making all these claims that fresh air does all this great stuff, but you've no statistical evidence whatsoever.
Yeah.
I've gone back and read some of those problems, and even I as a historian know that they were highly biased from the start, and particularly in terms of their sample selection. I think that would be interesting to do. There's some other academic who's going to have to do that particular project.
Well, it sounds like you have talked to some.
Oh, yeah, I've talked to quite a number, of dozens.
Adults now,
yep,
who were in
right.
the program.
And yeah, and what I found very quickly was that there was a saturation of the sample set, I know that term, very early on, because people were saying the same stories over and over again. Ones that I've referred to here are samples of dozens and dozens that I've received over the 10 years I've been working on this.
Well, I told you you should have studied economics.
I did once take a macroeconomics class from some professor named Yoder here. I can't remember quite who it was.
My name is Mark Sullen. I am a little curious about, it struck me that about the time that you're sort of closing your research on the Fresh Air program, you're going through the 70s.
79, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is the time that the Mennonite colleges are launching cross-cultural programs that are sort of doing the same thing in reverse. The idea that it's for some reason beneficial to send these mostly white, suburban kids, once they hit college, right, it changes the age level certainly, but to essentially send them on the same sort of adventure.
The immersion experiences.
And I'm not quite sure what to think of that yet, but it strikes me as interesting that in some ways, there are some strong parallels between these, and I wonder if what the white parents were hoping for their kids, sending them on the programs, I'm guessing it's a very different idea than what black and Hispanic parents were thinking about their kids going out.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very different, but there's a parallel there, and I'm curious about it.
It's a thoughtful question. I guess I would immediately have... I would problematize the paralleling of them because I'm familiar with some of those later 80s and 90s iterations of those immersion programs, and they're primarily based on the assumption that the city is a dangerous place that the kids need to be exposed to but never stay in. It's an introductory, almost an inoculation sort of experience. And I think it also comes from a very different place where it's largely the sending community is deciding that this is a good thing to do, rather than the receiving community deciding for the sending community that it's a good thing to do. So I think those power dynamics are pretty critical. I'd have to think more about that, but I think the parallels may be more cosmetic than substantive. I don't know, but yeah, thanks. It's good.
Tobin, I'm Peter Dula.
Yeah, Peter.
Thanks for a really great colloquium.
Sure.
And it brought back lots of memories for me of the Fresh Air kids I knew in Lancaster growing up. So one thing that stands out here in this picture, aside from the racial dynamics, is all the coverings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you have studied a vast range of these communities. And I'm wondering if you learned anything interesting about these kids' experience with Mennonites as opposed to others. Because it seems like there's... I mean, obviously, there's a cultural leap from New York City to a rural area, but there's a whole other cultural leap into these people that wear these funny things on their heads.
Yep.
So, wondering if anything interesting you come out of that.
How long do I have to answer these questions? That's a full chapter in my book, because in the minds of the Fresh Air Fund organizers, this big secular behemoth of an organization, the perfect hosts, and this is an actual quote, were Amish and Mennonite hosts. That's a lot to unpack. But the anecdotes I have, particularly of these black and brown children coming into the white Mennonite and Amish host settings, is just fascinating. For instance, there was a continual pattern, particularly of black girls, not so much black boys, coming into Amish and conservative families, and for that week or 2 weeks, dressing plain. And the exoticizing of those children, the process, and the way that some of the period observers are talking about black girls walking around in Amish costuming and particularly head coverings is just phenomenal. There's also disturbing parts of it, as you might imagine. Another anecdote, a young woman by the name of Margie Middleton from New York City had with her one friend come to a series of Mennonite families in Lancaster for many years when they were very young. Her friend converts and begins wearing the covering. She didn't. She doesn't get asked back, but her friend does. And she also talks about the process, this is Margie Middleton again, of coming home and having to brief with her mother, really, if it was really okay to dance, listen to the radio, and go swimming, because they'd been told that those were sins by their hosts in the country. I could go on and on with those stories, but absolutely incredibly rich, and a particular relationship that was recognized as being different and ideal. And that's where some of the work I'm doing around concepts of innocence begin to come into the fore, because you had this community being defined as not only religiously innocent and pure, but racially innocent and pure. Julia Kasdorf has done some interesting writing about the whiteness of the Amish. And then you've got these kids who are being allowed to come into that community because they're seen as being racially innocent and pure until they hit puberty. Then the relationships are pulled away. So yeah, it's read my book when it comes out.
Tobin, there's a resonance that I was hearing as you were speaking with the camping movement generally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And two things about that. That camping was good because it would expose kids to the natural environment,
right,
however that was determined. But also in terms of church camping, it was all about control of time, because yep, the whole deal was, if you send your kid to camp, they get all this exposure to church, to religion, to the Bible and whatnot, way more hours than if they go to Sunday school every week.
Right.
So
frequent quote.
Yeah. So I don't want to talk about parallels, but it just resonated with me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Leslie Paris and Abigail Van Slick have done some leading scholarship on the whole camping environment and the religious components of that. And I've used that to do some analysis of the religious instruction or lack thereof that was being brought forward through these programs. But one of the things I'm doing in this project as a whole is treating the camping environment and the home environments as part of a single movement, because everyone talked about it that way, even though there's some very different things going on. The camps were used also as a way to take troublesome kids and channel them there so that they wouldn't disrupt the communities in which they'd been sent. And there's really interesting stories about how the kids who'd been shunted in that way, like Lelia and I'm forgetting the other young woman's name that I told the story about, you were aware of that and pushed back against it. But again, the connection with the question about the religious instruction becomes very important in shaping the religious section of the Fresh Air movement as a whole. Yeah, it's definitely there. Again, I talk about that in the book.
Hi, Tobin.
Hey, Carol.
Yeah, I'm Carol Hurst, and I teach social work here. I want to ask, you alluded to the fact that there is sexual abuse did happen in some of the homes.
Yes.
And with your theme on innocence.
Right.
Lack of innocence. I'm wondering if you could tell us more what happened with some of those stories.
Yeah, the first person to really break that story publicly was a scholar by the name of David Heckler. And he actually had to sue the Fresh Air Fund in order to get access to records, to anecdotal information he had begun to hear by the families. This was in late 80s. He was successful in that. And what the Fresh Air Fund then began to do was, for the first time, this is an organization that was started in 1877, 1988, for the first time, they begin to vet the homes. That was only because of multi-million-dollar suits forcing them to do so, and some of these sexual abuse cases becoming public. Those are hard stories to tell, particularly because these children were being brought in at ages where they are absolutely and completely dependent upon the adults who are supposedly now taking over parental control. The story of a young woman who was placed in a Mennonite pastor's home in Kansas. He begins to fondle her the first summer, force her to do sexual acts on him the second summer, and only in the third summer did she actually think she could say no. Many other stories. And again, this is the the sexual abuse portion of the book that I deal with this at much greater length, again, is exploring what does it mean for someone who's presumably innocent to find that very space be the space where that innocence is violated, and then to have it covered up. And again, this isn't something that was just a function of the Fresh Air Fund. In the instance I referred to, the young woman came forward when she ends up at a Mennonite college, and people refuse to listen, believe that it had happened, even though that story is entirely consistent with what we know from the statistical reality. It had to have happened, and I've got other stories that corroborate that there and elsewhere. I go into the details of that in the book as a whole, but it was absolutely a part of it, and it's, again, problematic exploring what it is when we mean by innocence and when that is violated in the very midst of promoting it. It's a great question. Yeah. Thanks, Carol.
We have time for one more here. That's been waiting patiently.
Hi, Tobin.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Good.
It's Melody Pinnell.
Yeah, Melody. How are you?
I am looking at your research like this is my life. Because of coming again from the New York City Mennonite churches, Margie Middleton is my godmother.
Oh, yes,
I
yes.
saw the picture of 7th Avenue Mennonite Church with all of the Fresh
yep.
Air Fund children there. And of course, my father was a pastor, African-American pastor at 7th Avenue Mennonite Church. For those of you may or may not know, my mother is ethnic white Mennonite, and my father's African-American, both from Lancaster County. And ended up in Harlem. And so the Fresh Air Fund was, of course,
absolutely.
Very prominent along with the camp experiences. I myself went to Fresh Air Fund, but I was sent to my white mother's, my cousins, instead of strangers' quote unquote homes. So this is, I'm very, very grateful that you're doing this research. I think, too, the question I would have, I have a flood of emotions more than questions
sure,
right now.
Sure.
But the question I guess I would have on this is while this movement was going on, and of course a lot of the Mennonites took a stance to be non-political in what was happening in the civil rights movement, was there any research that came up about the position or what was taught or what was said with churches during this time while they were doing this movement?
Good.
And you understand what I mean
yeah,
as far
thanks,
as
Melody.
To try to help the civil rights movement, but yet being very non-pacifist in a sense in the civil rights movement.
So the quote that comes to mind, Melody, is one from a pastor in rural Kansas. He's being interviewed by the local newspaper about their initiative of a Fresh Air program. And it happens to be in 61, the same time that the Freedom Rides were going on. And he says, unlike the Freedom Riders, we have a better way of addressing race relations. It's a very telling quote, because it's clear they were thinking about the fact that they were doing this rather than engaging in marches in the streets. But it wasn't just an evaluation that this was an alternative. It was an evaluation that this was a superior option. So I explore that at length. There's very interesting dynamics that emerge not only in places like Newton, and northern Indiana and Elkhart area or Lancaster or other Mennonite locations where the population of Mennonites and Fresh Air programs are just very dense, that they were seeing this as a way to engage with the race problem. It was always done, though, with the assumption that they were not, and this is interesting at the time because this is when the church is struggling whether or not to develop and become active, and people like Vincent Harding and many others are challenging the church on this. And this actually, and I think I've got clear evidence of this, was a bit of a dodge, a way of protecting themselves from doing something that they were both culturally and theologically uncomfortable with. So it had a very important role in keeping some communities from being involved in a more activist stance, in addition to seeing it as simply another option. Yeah, thanks, Melody. It's a great question. Fred.
Thank you very much, Tobin, for a really stimulating talk. And I've noticed a number of hands that we weren't able to get to. I would just urge you to join us in the reception in Common Grounds after this, and where you'll have a chance to talk further with Tobin. See you next month on the third Wednesday. Lois, remind me. Heidi Wintersvogel will be talking about social justice theater. So join us then.